Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today I'm speaking with Eric Kingfisher about the major native conifers that we see every day as we walk in our neighborhoods and gaze out our windows. Eric is the stewardship director for the Jefferson Land Trust. Eric is also a local and statewide leader in conservation stewardship and innovative education programs. But before we talk about trees, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, that was the song. It's a bird, obviously. Now let's listen to its warning call. Well, on a slightly different note, the news of the invasive Asian giant hornet has been making headlines these days. Certainly, every time we talk about various invasive species, it's been clear that the core tenet of control and prevention of harmful impacts of invasives on our native ecosystems is early detection and rapid response. The Asian giant hornet is the world's largest hornet. The wingspan of an adult can be as much as 3 inches. And the female queen can be over 2 inches long. But more alarmingly, these giant hornets are voracious predators on many insect species, especially honeybees. Just a few Asian hornets can destroy an entire honeybee hive in just a matter of hours. The giant hornet was spotted last year and, unfortunately, again this year in Whatcom County near Bellingham. So now is the time to stop the spread and to eradicate these threats to our ecosystems. You can join a citizen science effort to help scientists locate and determine the extent of the spread of the giant hornets into Washington State. The Washington State Department of Agriculture is encouraging folks to set up homemade traps and report catches this summer from essentially July through October, the season that they're likely to be out. I looked at the information about building a trap, and all you need is a plastic bottle, some orange juice, and rice vinegar. I encourage you to go to the Washington State Department of Agriculture website to learn more about the Asian giant hornet and how you can stop the hornet from establishing a presence in our state. The website for the Department of Agriculture is www.agr.wa.gov/hornets. And now to my conversation with Eric Kingfisher. Eric is the stewardship director at the Jefferson Land Trust. And among Eric's many accomplishments is the fact that he provided the inspiration, designed, and is a major teacher with the Jefferson Land Trust Northwest Naturalist course. The course is aimed not only at increasing our understanding and appreciation of the natural world around us, but actually also at building a cadre of conservation leaders. This year, with our Stay Home, Stay Healthy world, Eric was one of the key naturalists for Jefferson Land Trust's Nature in Your Neighborhood program. With a smile, Eric describes himself as a really great dad, pretty good naturalist, and an all right musician. So welcome, Eric. I'm so glad you could join us on Nature Now.
Well, thank you. No, I'm happy to be here. I love the show.
Oh, great. I love it when people say that. You know, it's like talking into the great void. You never know if anybody's out there or not. Well, today we're going to talk with Eric about the forests and the trees. And as I sit here in my home on Zoom and looking out the window, I see almost entirely conifers. I see grand firs. I see Doug firs. There's one madrone in the distance. And I know we probably, that's what many of us see when we look out our windows. So at that level, Eric, we live in the evergreen state. Why are there so many evergreens?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. It's true. I mean, if all of the listeners just take a second and look out your windows, wherever you may be, chances are you're going to be seeing mostly conifers, these evergreen trees. And that's a feature of our landscape. I mean, where we live really is a land of trees. And why are they mostly these conifer trees? And when I say conifers, I mean these trees that have these needle-like leaves and woody cones. And there are some reasons why, you can imagine, ecological reasons why we have these trees and these kinds of trees. And it's got to do with our climate. So as you look out your windows and you start to think, okay, well, yeah, our climate is a nice climate. It's relatively mild. Some people call it a mild maritime climate, where we have wet winters, mild wet winters and dry summers. Now, our winters are not deeply freezing cold winters, mm-hmm. and our summers are not baking hot. It's a pretty mild climate in general. And what that does for our vegetation around here is the conifers, you know, we call these evergreen trees because they don't lose their needles in the winter. They're green all year long. These evergreen conifers actually can do more than 50% of their growing between October and April. So while all the broadleaf trees, these trees that lose their leaves during the winter, you know, they're dormant in the winter. They can't be doing any photosynthesizing during the winter because they don't have their photosynthesizing tools, their leaves. So already conifers have a bit of an advantage because it's so mild, they can just continue to grow through the winter and thrive. Now in the summer, sometimes it's so dry that photosynthesis just shuts down for all these different trees because they need to prevent water loss through their open pores. So in the summer times, that also is another disadvantage for these broadleaf trees and these deciduous broadleaf trees that have their leaves out during the summer to photosynthesize. Sometimes they just have to shut down even during that point. So it's another disadvantage for them.
I have a couple little facts you shared with me a while back that I just found were kind of really astounding. And you said that in our area, there are over 1,000 of the conifers, individual trees, for every broadleaf tree.
Yeah.
And then that the sort of total biomass per acre in the of trees is larger here than anywhere else on the earth. That's just astounding to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. This is an amazing place we live. We grow trees really well. if your listeners take a second and imagine their last visit up to Hurricane Ridge, and I hope that everybody who's listening has been to Hurricane Ridge. It's a world-renowned, world-class.
Yes.
It's only an hour and a half or so. Getting up to Hurricane Ridge and presuming you could see the day that you're there, you're looking out at the Olympic Mountains and you're looking up the Elwha Valley and you're looking up and across the Lillian Valley. So what you're seeing is evergreen conifers. You're seeing mostly Douglas fir, that carpet of green, that dark green. But if you look really closely, if you've got binoculars and you can look down into that dark carpet of green, you'll see the occasional broadleaf tree, like a big leaf maple or maybe some red alder down by the river bars. And that's where we can start to really understand and really comprehend the 1,000 conifers for every broadleaf tree.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you can really see that in those spaces. And indeed, the tonnage of biomass per acre is the world's highest in these maritime forests of the Pacific Northwest. The real champion forests in terms of biomass per acre are the redwood forests down on the North Coast of California and Southwest Oregon. And then the Olympic Peninsula this temperate rainforest belt is really where the tonnage of biomass per acre is the world's highest. Again, if you were to weigh the trunk, branches, foliage in an acre of Pacific Maritime Forest, it'd be more than any other kind of forest in the world.
So let's go down to the level of trees. I mean, you already mentioned Douglas firs as sort of the predominant tree in many places around here. I remember when I first moved to the Pacific Northwest some number of decades ago, a friend of mine was a forester, and I was asking her, you know, to tell me about these different species. And she says something about the Douglas firs. She says, oh, that's just your stereotypical Christmas tree. And I'm thinking, not where I grew up. So what are the few sort of basic characteristics that anybody looking at a forest could go, oh, I know that for certain is a Douglas fir?
Yeah, well, I, you know, if you see a conifer out your window, most likely it's a Douglas fir. I mean, they grow everywhere around us, and they grow in all the different ecosystem types that we have, from the shoreline all the way up to the subalpine zone. So they're well adapted to a very variety of different ranges or aspects of our land base here. What would help you identify a Douglas fir? And I hope that the listeners feel inspired to try and identify a Douglas fir if it's not something that they've tried before. Maybe after this session on listening to nature now, they might be inspired to step outside and go take a look at their nearest conifers and see if they can identify which is which. And some of the things you can use to identify the Douglas fir are its needles. Its needles kind of grow all the way around the twig, typically. It's not all the time, but typically a twig of a Douglas fir will have needles growing all the way around the twig, kind of like a bottle brush. It also has a very distinctive cone. The cone has these little bracts, these little forked bracts.
Sort of like a forked tongue coming out of each of the
scales.
Scales, yes.
Right,
thank you.
Exactly. And no other cones have that.
And the other thing I think about Douglas fir, you know, ones that are kind of old enough to get some years on them, is the bark is so distinctive. Sort of deeply furrowed. I don't know another tree that has that.
Yeah, the bark is typically going to have wider, thicker grooves in it than any of our other native conifers. So that shows up later on in its life. You start to really see that come in at about 50 or 60 or 70 years or so. And of course, these trees can live to be hundreds of years old, you know, even up to 1,000 years old. And in fact, they're one of the tallest species of trees in the world. A 1,000-year-old tree may be a 400 feet tall. It's an extraordinary tree, and it is one of the world's largest trees, one of the world's tallest trees, and they grow in abundance all around us.
So I'm now looking out my window again, and the other major tree that I see when I look out my window is the grand fir. Let's talk a bit about it.
Yeah, I love grand firs. If somebody asked me what my favorite tree is, I'd probably say grand fir.
And that's, why is that?
Yeah, just for me, it's I grew up partly on Southwest Whidbey Island, and they're co-dominant there, you know, in the forests along the bluffs and along the upper upland forest there, at least in the forest that I was, I spent a lot of time in growing up. It was kind of half grand fir and half Douglas fir. And so I just have an affection for them based on just all the time I spent with them. I think they're beautiful too. I like how they grow in a very conical form. If you find a grand fir in a, you know, sort of a pasture or a field or something, it's gonna have this very cylindrical shape. And I think it's just interesting how they do this. Their growth form has branches growing in this sort of uniform column that completely hides the trunk. So it's just this column of foliage going up, and it has beautiful form to me. So a thing that helps people identify grand fir is the needles tend to grow, at least on the branches that you see near the ground, horizontally. So they grow in all parts of the twig, but they all flatten out. And so you have these very flat splays of needles. And also their needles are the longest of all the needled trees, except for, say, a traditional pine tree, like a shore pine, mm-hmm. you might have around here, a western white pine. The grand fir needles are the longest needles of all the firs that we have around here. So that's another indicator. And you don't ever see their cones typically, because they grow on the tops of the trees and then they start to fall apart while they're still up there at the top branches. Occasionally you see a branch that's blown off from a wind event or something and find a cone on the ground, but it's pretty rare.
Well, and the other thing I have learned in terms of trying to identify the bark, because when I look at the grand firs around me, I mean, a lot of them have been limbed up a bit because it's an inhabited area. But the bark, and I understand this is true for all firs, but you need to check me on this, that there are a little sort of horizontal lines or bumps that go across the trunk.
Yeah.
Can you describe that better than I just did?
Yeah, they have these like resinous blisters that are sap filled. And I don't really know the function of them that is, but I mean, Douglas firs do that, even though they're not a true fir. True firs are those trees that have these cones that grow on the top branches, among other features. Douglas firs is interesting. Just it's unusual. It's like it took botanists a long time to just give it a name, and it went around and around because it doesn't really fit in any of the main categories. It's not a hemlock. It's not a pine tree. It's its own thing. It's not a redwood. So they call it Pseudotsuga menziesii, the Douglas fir. It's false hemlock. But the grand fir is a true fir, and it also has these resinous blisters. And again, you see that mostly on the younger trees. As it goes older, those start to disappear, and the bark becomes much more sort of thick and dense, mm-hmm. and rough, and it doesn't have, you can't see those very much anymore.
So you mentioned hemlock. I can't see hemlock out of the particular window I'm looking at, but I know if I walked around the house or in the yards, I could see the Western hemlock. Talk about that for a bit.
Okay, sure. Yeah, Western hemlock is maybe the most abundant tree probably the most abundant tree on the west end of the Olympic Peninsula, and it's also the state tree, Washington State tree, for what it's worth. It grows in a variety of different habitats as well. It tends to like a little bit more moisture, so not so much deep in the rain shadow. So in Port Townsend, you know, we get about 19 inches of rain a year, but you go down towards Quilcene, and you're pushing more like 60 inches of rain a year. And it's in those more moist environments, or even, you know, Chimicum South, where you start to see more and more hemlocks starting to co-dominate some of the native mm-hmm. forests. Hemlocks are a wonderful tree. They are incredibly shade tolerant compared to, say, a Douglas fir. They mm-hmm. grow underneath a canopy of Douglas fir that is not letting a lot of light through. So the forest floor in a mature forest doesn't have a whole lot of light reaching all the way to the forest ground cover. And Douglas firs need a lot of light, but the Western hemlock have an ability to germinate and grow in these very shady, moist environments. And their superpower is they can just kind of hang out there and grow slowly and slowly and slowly until a natural disturbance happens, like a wind event where a tree falls over, a bunch of trees fall over, and a lot more light hits the forest floor, at which point then the sapling Western hemlocks can start to grow more rapidly and fill that space. And so there are places in the Olympic Mountain or in the Olympic forests where you can find almost uniform stands of Western hemlock where there hasn't been a disturbance in a long time. So that the Western hemlocks, once they finally reach that canopy, they can start to grow underneath themselves and create this sort of uniform, what mm-hmm. some people used to call climax forest, of all almost entirely Western hemlock. They
and the Douglas fir can't grow in that.
That's right. Yeah.
Shade.
So,
yeah.
Right.
So one more conifer that we have in our area, the Western red cedar. Yeah. And that's it's a classic tree of the indigenous folks here. You think of the role of the cedar in their culture and their architecture and their art. Talk about that tree for a bit.
Yeah, it's a iconic tree, and it's a beautiful tree. It also grows in a range of habitats, even in the rain shadow environment here in Port Townsend. I'd call it our second most abundant conifer after Douglas firs, but it does really well. It does best in places where its roots can stay wet all year. And, you know, as far as identifying it, it has these branches that sweep down and then up at the ends. And that's a relatively distinctive feature.
Yeah. It's a very graceful flow for a branch. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And the leaves, you know, like the Douglas fir has needles. The other true firs have needles. Western hemlock has needles. The red cedar has these effectively scales, and the leaves are basically scales that just cover the twig and all these different, this layering effect. And it's very elegant and lacy looking. And the bark is also quite distinctive. It has this very stripped bark, or these sort of threads of bark that are ropey bark, some people call it. That is quite distinctive. No other tree around here has the bark like red cedar. And we call it a cedar, but it's not not a true cedar. As a botanist wouldn't call it a true cedar. It actually is in the cypress family.
So Eric, tell me one more thing about the red cedar. What makes it, or what are its characteristics that make it so important for the indigenous cultures?
Yeah, so the red cedar, some people would call it the tree of life around here for the indigenous people who've used it for thousands of years. It was just wildly useful. The bark itself, the inner bark specifically, could be used to weave any number of different things, from clothing to mats to everything, even diapers. I mean, it was used as a really valuable, abundant resource that was used for a variety of different things. The wood itself splits quite easily. And so this is what the longhouses were made out of around here. It was quite rot resistant, so it lasts a long time. It has some medicinal qualities to it, the foliage itself. There's a thousand different uses of red cedars.
Eric, this has been really interesting. And I hope as folks take their walks, they'll give some attention to the different kinds of conifers we have. But we have left out a whole nother group of trees that, even though they're not as common, are certainly important. And those are the deciduous or broadleaf trees. Would you be willing to come back in the not too distant future, and we'll spend some time talking about our broadleaf trees?
Yeah, that sounds fun. I love the idea. Yeah, I love the idea of our listeners thinking about our native trees, and perhaps they can go out after this show and start to familiarize themselves with the different trees we identified here today: Douglas fir, Western red cedar, grand fir, and Western hemlock.
This requires you to see the whole forest. The trees that sort of flop over on the top, what are those?
Right. So the droopy top trees are typically the ones are going to be the Western hemlocks. Red cedar is the top leader, with that very tip of the tree we call the leader. And the tip of the red cedar tip kind of droops over, but the Western hemlock droops over even more. So we think of the Western hemlock as the droopy top.
The droopy top tree. Okay. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Eric. And we'll come back and talk about our broadleaf trees in the not too distant future. Thanks a bunch.
You bet.
I've been hearing this song a lot recently in my yard. The maker is the plucky Buick's Wren. That's pronounced like Buick the car, but it's spelled B-E-W-I-C-K, for an ornithologist friend of John James Audubon. The Buick's Wren is nimble, acrobatic, and highly energetic. Only the male Buick's Wren sings to attract a mate and defend his territory. Although the songs can vary a great deal from place to place, the Cornell Ornithology Lab website, All About Birds, describes the songs as usually beginning with a couple of high, quick notes, followed by a low, burry phrase, and ending with a high trill, with the occasional warble or buzz put in between. Buick's Wrens are a medium-sized wren with a subdued brown-gray body and a long, brow-like white stripe over its eye. Males and females look the same. And as they scurry through bushes, these little birds often flick their upward tilting tails as they hop from branch to branch. In addition to their cheery songs, I often hear the bold and scolding calls. Both males and females utter these harsh, raspy calls to defend their territory or to scold intruders in the backyard where they have a nest in a nearby bush. Males generally begin the nest building and sometimes build multiple nests. The female chooses amongst her favorites, picks a nest, and then continues to finish the nest building, lining it with feathers, wool, hair, or plant down, and adding a final inner lining, often using bits of snake skin. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news, stories, and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays after the community resources and calendar, with repeats here on KPTZ, that's at 91.9 FM, Thursdays at 5 o'clock after the local news, and on Saturdays at 12:30. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. The ending song is a piano solo written by Bill Mayerl, and it's called The Song of the Fir Tree.